Actually get there we go. Look at us. We're I feel like I'm now graduated to second grade. Can you get in? You can watch the people coming in, right?
Can you
Do I need to access you or give you?
give me access here because it's not showing.
Okay, share multiple. Why is this? I don't know how to do it. Never mind. I'll just figure it out as we go along. Anyway, I'm just going to keep going. Bear with me. We're getting there eventually. Okay. Smart information. Do you see the second screen? Help me, please. Tell me you can see the second screen. Zoom slide.
No.
No. Okay. This is. Shoot. I don't know how to. Oh, there we go. Now, can you see the second screen? The smart
No.
information?
No. I can't.
Do a share screen again.
A share screen. Okay.
And then click on the presentation. The right one. And hit share.
There you go.
Okay, that was Mallory, our speaker. She's younger than me too, so that's why this is all working. Okay, so I think this is going to look the same on your end for those who are doing this virtual. Let me see if I can get it to go. Next screen. Now it won't let me. Dang. Sorry.
We have to go about that meeting. And my
Well, I got. How come I can't forward it? Do you know? It's so frustrating.
this is a screen you're sharing,
Yeah.
which should be sort of
I'm right here.
When you go into screen, what screen is that? Like when you click on this, is there a drop down that comes on the box?
Sorry.
Yes. Oh.
The screen.
I think so, yeah.
We're sharing, so we need to go now to screen two.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
You have like another.
Maybe here?
Yep, it's going to be one of these two that you
Okay.
can't open.
Okay. I'm guessing it's this one.
Yeah, that looks like it changed the screen up there. So
There we
here we
go. Yeah.
go.
All right. We're going to continue on. The shop, this workshop is being recorded. We just want to give a thanks to Melina for the sponsorship, and then there'll be a $25 gift card up from Walmart coming up at the end. If you're still here, we're going to find somebody randomly off of the list of attendees. I am just going to get right into it since we're kind of behind already. I'm really happy to introduce Mallory Peters. She's built her career through hands-on experience across the senior living and long-term care industry, working in roles that include housekeeping, dining services, maintenance, caregiving, medication technician, and leadership. Her experience across both direct care and operations gave her a deep understanding of the challenges seniors, families, and care providers face through the aging journey. She's also really good at tech. Today, Mallory works with ResHab as a marketer and educator, helping connect individuals and families with resources that support independence, long-term care planning, and quality of life. She is especially passionate about educating professionals and communities about Medicaid programs, including the A&D waiver, and helping simplify complex systems for the people navigating them. Her background in senior living and passion for advocacy continue to shape her work in building relationships, educating others, and improving access to care and service. Okay, so I think what I'm going to do now, because this is a hybrid, we're going to try, and I got to get to her presentation. So I'm going to stop sharing here. And this is just really cumbersome. I'm going to share. I'm going to open hers up, this one.
Hit Chrome tab. Or window, sorry. Very nice.
No, good. There you go.
Share.
Share. Okay, can you guys see her rehabilitation slide, or are you still on speaker? Sorry, you're going to have to help me get through this.
I can see it.
The rehab part?
Yes. Well,
okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, that's great. So now I just got to get it up on the other screen. Oh my gosh. Well, I can. Oh,
I haven't did that computer just so I could look at that.
Oh, wait, you know what? This is what I need to do. Hold on. There we go.
There we go.
Okay. I think we're good. So I'm going to let Mallory start. And I don't even know how to get the camera on now that we set up the camera. So you're just going to have to, you'll be the mystery woman behind, the slide.
That's okay. That gives me the ability to come out here and kind of see what I'm talking about a little bit better. So thank you so much for the introduction. That was really great. I have grown up in the senior living world, I call it. I started at Spring Gardens over in Meridian. I worked as a med tech housekeeper. I mean, I filled in all the roles, and it's just because I really love to help people. And so with that, I naturally started growing within the senior living industry. And I was transitioned over to a sales and marketing role first, which I really love because I love to tell people about the opportunities, about the benefits of senior living. I did see a lot of potential for assisted living and how it could really enhance the quality of life for clients that are suffering from potentially isolation, mobility issues, just challenges that start to arise as we start aging. And what I started noticing in that sales and marketing seat, especially, was that a lot of people don't plan for long-term care. The scary part is 4 out of 5 people are going to need some type of long-term care in their life. And again, a lot of people do not plan for that. And so while in that sales and marketing seat, I saw a lot of people searching for assisted living options. And a lot of people had limited funds or were on Medicaid and trying to get into these care options. Again, due to a lack of planning, that is the route that they have gone. The problems with this are assisted livings are a business, and so they have to balance the bottom line, unfortunately. Medicaid pays pennies on the dollar compared to our private pay residents. In assisted living, your average cost of care for a studio apartment, for just the studio apartment itself, is probably running somewhere about $3,500 to $4,500 a month, depending on the community that you go into. And then there is a care charge on top of that, where they go over where the person is independent, where they could use some support. They generate a care plan from that, and that lands them into a cost associated with that care that the staff is going to provide that person. Those care plans can range anywhere from $500 a month at level one up to $6,000 a month to a high level 5, high level 6. Some communities don't take those high levels of care because they start really taxing the staff and causing issues trying to meet those levels of care in those high populated communities. And so a lot of these communities, again, they're balancing the bottom line. They have rooms to fill, again, at those private pay rates. And so people come in and they're not ready for that. There is always a sticker shock when people come to assisted living and they realize, oh my gosh, it's going to cost me $5,000 a month to live here.
I don't even pay that at home. Now, yes, keep in mind, when you are living in an assisted living community, you are talking about your rent or mortgage, right? That's all included in there. Utilities are included in there. Your food is included in there. And then your care. So that could be medication management, assistance with ADLs, whether that be showering assistance, toileting assistance, dressing, mobility around the room, those type of things are what is evaluated for a level of care in assisted living. The problem again is when people come in and they're not expecting that $5,000 a month. And again, that's just a very average ballpark for assisted living. They're not expecting that. So some people have $20,000, $100,000 in the bank, $5,000 a month. That does not last very long. Okay. So we need to kind of start talking about a plan. What are we going to do? What are we going to do to be able to meet that need? Because the biggest risk with aging is running out of funds. Nobody knows when our end date is, unfortunately. And so how do you plan for that? How do you plan for an undetermined amount of time to be able to make sure that you can get the care that you need? And potentially leave a legacy for your kids, because that's the other big thing. So, you know, when I was in assisted living, filling those rooms, there was always this lingering issue, and it was people coming in on Medicaid or needing to roll to Medicaid, and I couldn't house them. I had empty rooms, but I could not put them there because of the bottom line. My companies didn't want Medicaid in the building because they didn't pay like private pay clients, okay? That is a very frustrating scenario when you're there to help people. You have space to help them and you can't put them there. So that triggered me to continue my journey. And I started navigating all the different assisted livings. I worked as a placement agent. So I learned that this is not a singular problem for one assisted living. It's all over the valley, and it's going to be in all aspects of assisted living, certified family homes, skilled nursing facilities. They're all dealing with this challenge of Medicaid and making sure that people have the right coverage for Medicaid to be able to still receive care. And so through this, I did spend some time with Iowa Medicaid planning, and we're going to go over some of that in the next slide. But I realized that there are a lot of myths out there about Medicaid, and there are a lot of strategies that can actually help people utilize Medicaid to fund their care, while, again, still being able to preserve a legacy for your kids, preserving the lifestyle for maybe a spouse at home that is not ready to go into care, or just being able to really tap into the A&E waiver, specifically your long-term care Medicaid. Before I started this journey with Iowa Medicaid planning, I am within assisted living, and just a little more background, I actually obtained my administrator license within assisted living, and so I was able to run a building, essentially being the CEO of the building, and that's really where I kind of finalized the, you know, this is the balancing the bottom line, and all that kind of stuff. So, lost my train of thought. So came over to Iowa Medicaid planning, and I came under the information that there's actually about 17 different programs under Medicaid. I had no idea. I thought once you qualified for Medicaid, you were on Medicaid. I didn't realize that there's different tiers, different waivers and things like that that will affect somebody's overall ability to qualify for different services. So we're going to jump into that a little bit more, like I said, down the line. But again, with Idaho Medicaid planning, there was still this lingering issue. We get people on Medicaid, but then what? Where do they go? So I have now transitioned into a role with Bonita ResHab. And with ResHab, we work with all adults with disabilities. So Bonita specifically is a company that supports several different ResHab agencies. We're a hub of agencies, essentially. And our mission statement is to support, to bring joy to life-changing work by supporting and resourcing business ownership group of residential rehabilitation, other social services fields. And so we do that by supporting these different ResHab agencies. Well, what is ResHab? I had a handful of clients that were on Medicaid on an A&E waiver looking for placement. And while I was at Idaho Medicaid planning, I spoke with Ron about these particular clients that I had that were very hard placement, Medicaid with behaviors. Potentially, I've had Medicaid seniors that are felons that need placement and care still. I have had individuals with dementia and just family dynamics that have gotten in the way and made it very challenging to find placement for them. And again, finances is another piece to this puzzle. So we're all trying to figure out how to make the pieces work to be able to get somebody into the right setting. So through that journey, Ron told me I need to speak with Elder Gannon for ResHab services. I discounted it initially because my understanding with ResHab was they work with developmental disabilities. And yes, that is true, but Idaho and actually health and welfare is designed to, it's actually designed to help provide care for those with disabilities, and there's different programs. And so for our seniors needing care, there are a couple different programs that we can qualify for. There's the long-term care program, and then there's the A&D waiver program. And so we'll be going over that again, trying to focus on ResHab here, because the second half of my presentation is going to be diving more into the Medicaid side of things. So what is ResHab? So like assisted living and certified family homes, ResHab provides a supportive living situation. So we help our clients with the activities of daily living, just like the staff do in an assisted living. We help with the toileting, dressing, showering, mobility issues. We can help with transportation, doctor's appointments.
Recording.
The thing that's unique about us is because we have essentially a higher level of care, because our clients have to go through one more step, we're able to help with more transportation than assisted living. So more than just like appointments, transportation to doctor's visits. We're also able to help get our clients to, like if they wanted to, there's an activity at the senior center they wanted to go to, or a family party, for instance, they wanted to go to, they need support during that time. We send a chaperone with them to be able to care for them during that. That way the family can enjoy the party and not have to, you know, balance the responsibility of the care and the party. Everybody can just enjoy being there, and we take that responsibility away from families, but everyone can just enjoy that setting. So, again, we offer support for any adult with disabilities that needs care due to functional or cognitive decline. It is an alternative to assisted living and skilled nursing facilities, and we do that by providing 24-hour care for our clients in those settings. So we don't have live-in staff. They do go in for shift work, so our morning swing and nocturnal shift. And we, so services within our communities that we provide. So again, we foster independence with our clients by helping them where their functionality is limited. We want to keep supporting them to be independent where they're at for as long as they can be. That is our goal. Clients in our setting are also, they are technically independent, so they can come and go as they want. They just have to let our staff know so that we know if we need to go look for them. If safety becomes a concern, someone's leaving and not coming back, then we want to make sure that we've got, you know, we go look for them, make sure that we're doing our due diligence to keep that person safe. If
Oops,
you'll back
sorry,
up one
go
for me,
back. Okay,
sorry.
sorry. Okay.
Let's see. Oh, one more.
One more, back up one more.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay.
So again, we can help with assistance with mobility, the socialization aspects, so getting out into the community at different functions. We can help with medication management, just like assisted living. One of the big differences there, our staff cannot do insulin injections. So if someone coming into ResHab would need to be able to do their own insulin injections, we can still meet that need as long as they can be independent of that. But outside of that, we can help with medication, transportation, grocery shopping, and support. So one cool thing about this that again is different from assisted living and skilled nursing facilities. In assisted living or skilled nursing facility, Medicaid designates how much of your income you get to keep for personal needs allowance. In a skilled nursing setting, they allow you to keep $40 a month. Everything else is assigned to the facility with what's called shared cost. In an assisted living setting, you get $39 of your personal income before everything else is assigned to the facility for shared cost. So that's one thing people don't realize. When their funds are already limited and they're going into these settings for Medicaid to take over, they still have a portion that they are required to cover before Medicaid is going to kick in and remain. And again, the total amount that a facility would collect on this client is going to be minimal compared to a private pay client. Yes.
I just wanted to ask a question. Can you clarify, so the $139 that does that also look to, do we have to apply that to their share of cost? I think that's a common question.
Yes. So the way that it works with share of cost, a client is going to continue receiving their income as they always have. So your income will come to your bank account like it always has. The difference is the community that you live in is going to receive this A&D waiver, which we're going to talk about more, from Medicaid. That A&D waiver has been designated a couple things on there.
The first thing is a RUF. Everybody on Medicaid, on an A&D waiver, and long-term care is required to pay that RUF. In the state of Idaho, it's $859 a month. That is your rent, utilities, and food portion. That is what your responsibility is for rent, utilities, and food. And then the sheriff files is in addition to that. So they're going to take somebody's income. They're going to take their gross income, essentially, minus $139, and that remaining amount minus the $859 will be your share of cost. So $859 is included in the share of cost. The $139 a month is what you're allowed to keep out of your income. So your income comes into your bank. Everything but the $139, you're writing a check for that amount to the facility to pay the facility. You need to keep your $139 in your bank. Yes.
So that $139, is that across the board depending on your income? Is that only what you can keep every month?
Yes. In assisted living, in skilled nursing, it's 40. And the reason is because they say, well, you make so much money, you're required to pay a portion of your cost of care before we're going to kick in and pay that. So, yes, it's across the board in assisted living, across the board in skilled nursing. It's called a personal needs allowance, and that's the number. And it goes up a little bit every year. Last year, I think it was $142 a month, now it's $139. So not too much each year. But that's what they allow trying to keep their own income before they everything else goes towards share of costs. So in our setting in ResHab, because our clients were set up a little bit different, because our clients are a tenant in the house, we coordinate housing with landlords throughout the valley. We do corporate leases with them, so our clients don't have to worry about signing a long-term lease or meeting the tenants dealing with the landlords. We kind of are the middleman between that. So if there's any issues with meeting the, what's on the lease, then we work with our clients to make sure that we help them make sure they're meeting the lease requirements. We also help make sure that they're paying the rent. And our clients in that setting, they're going to split the utilities between the two to three clients in that house because our setup are single family homes. So we've got some apartments, some townhouses, but typically our two to three bedroom homes are our setup. And so in our setting, again, their personal income, we're seeing our clients are getting to keep about $1,300 a month in personal income. Now, again, keep in mind that they're going to be required to pay a rental portion. So they split the rent between the clients in that house. So we're seeing about $500 to $600 a month in rental costs out of that $1,300. And then we're seeing about $100 a month in utilities because, again, the house mates are splitting the utilities. And then our setting, you're also responsible for providing your own food. But we would help our clients obtain a food stamp benefit if that's appropriate so they can help manage that as well. And we'll help them with the grocery shopping, meal planning, meal prep still. But they're ultimately responsible and get more control over their food in this setting as well. Did you have a question?
Yes. So if the member has a health plan that provides them supplemental benefits that give them access to food, grocery.
Yes.
Sometimes even utilities.
Yes.
Is that counted towards that?
It's not. No.
You just want to make sure. That
yeah. No. Everybody. You're from Molina, correct?
Yes.
Perfect. Yeah. No, it's not. It's not counted towards. So that's a great additional benefit for our seniors. Actually, is to have those advantage and supplemental. Let's see.
I don't. Yeah. You probably. Yeah,
so this is good. We can stay here for now. Okay. So. With ResHab, and we'll go, again, we're going to go over the A&D waiver, but with ResHab, once someone's on the A&D waiver, they actually have to go through one more step to get qualified for our services. That next step is called a CIBAR, and that's going to be on the next page.
Oh my goodness.
Actually, we're going to go to the next page.
Okay.
There we go.
Is that it? Let me see.
I'm really people you want. Somebody has a question in the chat that says, what about the DD?
The DD waiver? So DD waiver is a little bit different. That's the Developmental Disabilities Waiver. That is going to be for a person who has had a disability they've obtained before and prior to the age of 22. That person would have to be able to provide documentation on that disability, proving that they had that in order to tap into the DD waiver. To be 100% honest, the DD waiver is not my field of expertise because I come from the senior living realm. I started with Benita solely for the A&D waiver side of things. The service has been around for a long time for AND waiver res have. People didn't really realize how to tap into it. It's more commonly used for the DD waiver. So for DD waiver, I do believe that they get to keep some of their income as well. But again, that unfortunately, it's not my area of expertise. I know that if we can get them flipped on the AND waiver, sometimes we get more benefits that open up for them. So it kind of just depends on the client and their needs and how long they've had this disability, which would be the most beneficial route. But I unfortunately, I'm really sorry, I don't have a solid answer for you on personal needs allowance for a DD waiver.
It's the same.
It is the same? Okay, perfect. So again, so our clients coming into ResHab have to go through one more step, which is that CIBAR. So our first step is going to be qualifying for the AND waiver. We'll kind of blow through this really quick because I'm going to dive into it more in the next PowerPoint. But for AND waiver, our clients are going to qualify on two different levels first. They're going to qualify financially, and then they're going to qualify medically. So to qualify financially, our resources have to be in line, have to be under $2,000 a month. And then our income also has to be in line. For a single person in the state of Idaho, 2026, an income has to be under $3,002 gross per month in order to qualify. Now, if your income is over that or your resources are over that, that doesn't mean you cannot qualify for Medicaid. That's where some of those strategies, a Medicaid planner would come into play. So we can kind of go over some of that again in the next slide, some strategies, and we'll help you guys build the financial overview so that you can take a look at somebody's situation and see, oh, would this be a Medicaid planner situation, or are these some simple fixes that we can do to get somebody in position to qualify? So once they qualify financially and they get that approval, they are going to now need to qualify on the medical side of things. So in order to do that, they're going to see where this person is. If they are at home, they're going to qualify for or request a home care AND waiver. If they're in assisted living, just the AND waiver. If they're in a skilled nursing facility, it's long-term care Medicaid that someone's requesting. And the medical eligibility is going to be determined a little bit different in most settings. So for home care and assisted living, it has to be a primary care provider or doctor of the client has to sign off. There's a specific form of Medicaid that they have to sign saying that this client needs help with two or more activities of daily living. And once Medicaid receives that, then they will send a digital referral over to the Long-Term Care Bureau of Nurse Reviewers for them to reach out to you in about 4 weeks to schedule that UAI. And that UAI is a uniformed assessment indicator is what that's called. It is a nurse review assessment is what it's another term that people use for it. And that assessment is where the nurse reviewer is going to come in. She's going to figure out where somebody needs help, where they're independent, and help generate that care plan. That's also going to help dictate the share of costs, and well, really the number, it's called the daily rate. So what a facility can bill per day for that client. And that does sometimes affect availability, unfortunately. The scary part about that is that that UAI cannot be scheduled until somebody's in the facility that they want to end up in. So that does create some problems when we're looking at assisted living or certified family homes. These facilities, again, because they are big businesses balancing the bottom line, they do not like to take people in this Medicaid pending status. They want that AND waiver in their hand. And in order to get that, you have to have that UAI done. Well, the nurse reviewer doesn't want to come visit you until you're in the facility that you're going to end up in. So that can cause a lot of challenges. All right, switch this slide for me. So when we're looking at ResHab, again, we're going to determine a level of care. So that person will have to go through the AND waiver process, be reviewed by the nurse reviewer. That nurse reviewer is then going to make a referral to the CIBAR. So the CIBAR is a scale of independent behavior revised assessment. It's an hour and a half long assessment that's going to look over the functional limitations and abilities of the client and get more in depth of where we can help them out, where they're independent. And that is going to create a score for us. And that score will land somebody into a level of care. So you can switch slides for me. So here are two of the levels of care that are offered in ResHab. The other one is hourly support, but where we at Benita really shine is our high support and our intense support. So high support is going to be 24-hour care for a client in that one staff to 2 to 3 client setting. And then our intense support is going to be one staff, one-on-one, staff and client 24 hours. So that's where we can get A lot of times our sex offenders are falling into that, our high behaviors are falling into that, and our really high levels of care are going to fall into that intense support. Switch slides, perfect. So this is just another roadmap reviewing that AMD waiver process, kind of highlighting some of the bottlenecks for having somebody come into Res Hub services. So again, we're going to apply for the AMD waiver. We're requiring. Excuse me. We are going to apply for Medicaid and request the AMD waiver. A lot of people are coming to me on aid to the aged, aid to the disabled, aid to the blind, the AABD programs. ResHab and the AMD waiver does fall under those programs, but it's a specific waiver that has to be assigned to somebody under those programs. And so this is one of the biggest confusions that I get, is people coming to me looking to get into ResHab services and they just have a Medicare savings program, which is Medicaid paying your Part B premiums of Medicare, or they're coming to me with the aid to the aged, aid to the disabled, or aid to the blind, which are some cash pay benefits, some food stamps, and health insurance benefits, but ultimately they're not going to help any of the living costs associated with like certified family homes and assisted livings. So that's our AMD waiver. So once we get our financial approval there, then we get sent in lines for the UAI. Again, this is going to take about 4 weeks for that nurse reviewer to reach out and schedule with us. Once she reaches out and schedules, she does that assessment, and now she's going to send a referral over to the CIDAR. Well, there's another 2 to 4 months before we can get into the CIDAR. We cannot bill for Medicaid services in ResHab until somebody gets approved through the CIDAR. We can backbill, but we can only backbill to the date of the UAI. So anybody who is not on an AMD waiver yet is a bumpy ride getting into ResHab, just a heads up. And those people are also, if you are waiting to go into assisted living until you are applying for Medicaid, again, that is gonna be a bumpy ride because we have no control over the timelines for Medicaid. We have no control over how long it takes the nurse reviewer to reach out and schedule. And there's 2 nurse reviewers in the whole valley. And so they are very bogged down. That's why we are weeks out. And then with the CIBAR, Liberty Health is the only company in the state of Idaho that's contracted to do that assessment for health and welfare. And they, again, are very bogged down. A lot of people are wanting to transition this direction. And so pre-planning can be a very, very big deal. Go ahead and switch to the next slide for me. So within ResHab, these are some of the types of clients that we have been very successful with. So adults who have suffered from a TBI, great option for them. Our Parkinson's clients, our stroke clients recovering from stroke, Alzheimer's and dementia. Now, I will give one caveat with Alzheimer's and dementia. We are not a secured unit. So if somebody is a wanderer or elopement risk, and that's a safety concern, I am not an appropriate route. I'm going to be 100% honest. We do not lock our houses. In some of our houses, like if we have pleasantly confused residents that fold in and they do well there, we can manage that. But we have chimes on the door to help our staff alert if somebody goes outside. But again, it's not a secure unit. So nighttime wandering, that kind of stuff can be a very huge challenge and a safety risk. So I wouldn't say if somebody is, a wanderer or open risk, memory care is definitely going to be the more appropriate route for them. Somebody's dealing with seizure disorders. Our elderly adults that are starting to be a little assistance with their functional limitations. A lot of times, mobility issues we can help with. Now, our biggest challenge with mobility issues: somebody's in a big one, wheelchair, or a wheelchair, a manual wheelchair. Even some of our houses don't accommodate that, and so it again, it's picking pieces of a puzzle and trying to put everything together so that. We can get the right space for the client, meet their needs and preferences. We also help with vision impairment, behavioral clients. A lot of our clients will also benefit from another company that we need to support all the way through counseling and wellness. They offer CBRS, peer support, and case management services, which CBRS is a skills building program to help clients who are suffering from dual diagnosed mental health issues. To be able to build skills and just be more independent, building some independence there. So within ResHab, we also take clients that have a history of substance or alcohol abuse. We do look at this on a case-by-case basis because it does become very challenging if someone's still currently practicing their substance or alcohol abuse. It's a very difficult situation. We can also help again with sex offenders, felons. We do not require someone to have financial PLA or a guardian sign. So clients coming into res have, we don't require that. And again, our mental health clients and anybody with physical disabilities that we can help support. Those are clients that we've been successful with in res have. And switch to the next.
Okay, I'm gonna try. It's been challenging. Okay, did it go? No, dang it, I have to find it again. Sorry, I had to let people in. Dang it, sorry.
I think the last slide.
Oh, here.
Okay, here we go.
I tried it.
This is just to consolidated list of why people would choose res have over assisted living or family home. So some of the biggest reasons are our ratios, because those households, everybody in our house is going to get a pressure room. I think that's on the list too, actually. In skilled nursing and assisted living, and a lot of times in certified family homes, they need to be shared room situation for a client on Medicaid to help with those the limited funds that are coming from Medicaid. But that does present some other challenges for clients when they're used to having their own space. In ResHab, our clients can bring in their animals. So a lot of assisted livings will allow pets, but in our setting, we help our clients get a BSA letter, emotional support animal letter, so that they don't have to pay the pet deposit, and they can have those pets in the house. We understand that those a lot of times are enhancing the quality of life for our clients. Our setting allows people to continue living in regular housing out in the community rather than a big facility type setting. Our clients also, we work to get them out into the community about 3 to 5 times a week with one-on-one care. So we schedule those outings. Those can be your family parties, your counseling visits, your just outings during the day that someone wants to get to. We'll help make sure that they're supported during that. Again, everybody gets their private room. A lot of times those big facility settings with a lot of clients in them, you're going to start, they're not going to be able to house your sex offenders or your felons because they've got a building full of vulnerable adults, they call it, in our setting because they are smaller and can get, typically those clients, we can get them on intense so we can have one-on-one care. We can house it independently with a staff member so that they can be supported. But we're not, you know, putting other clients at risk.
So Mallory, yes. Really one question I have is like, if you do have vulnerable adults in one home, are they also mixed in with the felons and the sex offenders, or are there homes that are just for?
Just for, yes.
Just for the
so vulnerable adults? We have 100 homes throughout the valley because each, we support about 10 different agencies, and each agency can have about 10 houses, so 30 clients essentially. And so, our sex offenders and our felons, we are very careful with when we're placing them. So okay. We're going to want to be aware of these things prior to placing them so that we can be aware, like our felons a lot of times can't be housed with other felons. So that creates some issues. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not going to want to put a sex offender with a couple sweet old ladies. So we are definitely mindful of this. A lot of times, again, our sex offenders are going to qualify for that intense care. So they would be housed independently with staff there to help them.
Okay.
It's a case-by-case basis. And everybody gets a choice in ResHab. So the clients that are in the house and the client moving into the house, we are going to introduce everybody, make sure everybody feels like that's a good fit. The client, the housemates there have to say yes before we move somebody in. So everybody gets a choice. So if things start going awry, we're going to work to move that client within our houses. And if for some reason one of our agencies cannot meet their need anymore, then we would send them back to the group to transition to a different ResHab agency.
Okay.
That's one of the good things about working with us at Benita is that you're not just working with one ResHab agency.
Can I ask something? So my background, I worked in adult protective services.
Okay.
So a lot of times, you know, we worry like, if we're placing someone in a ResHab, who's going to be around them? And I can tell you from experience, a lot of times when people are placed in ResHab and they do have a history, you know, it's important to remember that at times when people did, you know, get the criminal history,
mm-hmm.
They may have been having a psychiatric issue, mm-hmm. or something like that. So when people are on their meds and, you know, they have that extra community resource out there that's helping them continue to live independently, mm-hmm. like they have people that are redirecting them and all that kind of stuff. So if, you know, you don't have to be afraid that they're just left alone to do whatever they want. And there are always people living in those houses, or, you know, staying in those houses, staff is staying in those houses, and making sure that they're there to support them so that they are living and can be respectful of other people.
Yeah,
I know that's a common fear for people.
Yeah, and we definitely, I get the question a lot. People are like, oh my gosh, because one of the questions that I ask on my intake are, do you have a history of substance or alcohol abuse? Do you have a history of interaction with law enforcement? Because those are things that I want to be aware of, not because I want to run for the hills or not take this person, just because we want to make sure that we have the proper placement in place. You know, we're giving the proper guidance. We want this to be a long-term solution for everybody. So it's important to do those deep digs and make sure we understand what's going on with the client. So again, we can place them in the appropriate housing that's gonna work for the long term. And there are situations where, you know, like I have houses that I have two males in a house, and we've said, hey, we've got this gentleman, he's a sex offender. You guys are not felons. Are you willing to take him in? And so, you know, there are situations where we have blended the two, but it's a case by case. We want to make sure everybody's safe, everybody feels good about that decision moving forward. So last thing on this is keeping control over more of your money. So again, having more control over your food and more of your money, so that you get those higher personal needs allowances. And then in assisted living and skilled nursings, often they are guided by a dietitian that has to help generate their menus. Those settings are typically offering one to two entrees per meal that you can choose from, or like a cold menu option. So in our setting, you're going to have more control, more options for food choices. And again, we can help with planning, the prep, and the grocery shopping, but ultimately you've got more power and choice in that aspect. So, yes.
So are you all over the state?
So Bonita companies are all through the Treasure Valley. We do have houses from Mountain Home, Boise, Eagle, Meridian, Cuna. We've got Nampa, Caldwell, Paya, and Fruitland. And then we do have some DD companies that are in Coeur d'Alene area. But that's just our Bonita companies. I know that there are ResHab companies all over the state. I'm still kind of building my list. I've had a lot of questions on like ResHabs that are available in Twin Falls. I know that there are some areas that are you know, lacking in this resource a little bit more. I know Bonita is definitely wanting to grow, and so we're expanding our different agencies within different areas. But ResHab is available throughout the state. Just with our companies, it's going to be specific to Treasure Valley.
One last question. Yes. So I don't want to assume, but are the homes like male only, female only?
It depends. So again, during our intake, we ask questions to our clients, like, do you have preferences on your housemate's gender? Do you have preferences on if they're older than you or younger than you? Do you have preferences on the staff that help you, their gender, that kind of thing? So we try to, again, match those preferences. We give everybody a say. So we do have, we've got houses that are only male. We do have some that are only female houses, and then we've got our co-ed houses. So it just depends. Most of our houses are trying to go more towards that co-ed, because you get a better blend of what's going on. We have some male houses that are just like, you know, no decorations, and just not a lot of like oomph to them. And so we feel like sometimes having a blend is really a useful strategy, but it just depends. And I think that might be my last slide before my phone number. So if there's anybody that you are interested in referring to ResHab, or you have questions about Medicaid or any way, I'm happy to answer those for you. This is my phone number and my email address, so feel free to write that down. And then I think we're going to get switched over to the second PowerPoint that I have here for you guys. And this one will relate to the document that was on the table over here. So if you guys didn't get that document, feel free to grab that. This particular presentation is going to be a combination of what I learned through my 9 months with Idaho Medicaid plan. So while she's pulling that up, I'll tell you a story. I am very passionate about Medicaid planning and being able to tap into the A&B waiver, but also being able to preserve assets. And the biggest reason is because while I was at Idaho Medicaid planning, Ron Hill was telling me about how he came into this business. And he found a company called Krause Agency. It's a law firm over in Wisconsin. And the president of Krause Agency's mom needed to go into long-term care.
And so he started navigating this journey and again was surprised by the cost of long-term care. And he's thinking, you know, what do our senators do? What are our what do the big dogs do that to get their parents through this? Because I'm sure they don't pay these costs while getting their parents the care that they need. And so he started diving into it. And what he found was that you can have two people. We're going to call them Paul A and Paul B. They were born on the same day, in the same hospital, the same town, same year. They went to the same school. They had the same upbringing. They went to the same college and worked the same career. The only difference is Paul A over here, he lived paycheck to paycheck. He didn't put anything away. He didn't say anything. He used drugs and he drank and he was a womanizer. He did whatever he wanted with his money. He made it, but he lived paycheck to paycheck. He retires, and the day after he retires, he has a stroke and needs to go into long-term care. He applies for Medicaid and he gets A and D waiver. He goes into long-term care. They fund his stay, no problem. Paul A or Paul B over here, meanwhile, he retires, has a stroke the day after he retires. Now, Paul B over here, the difference is he has planned. He has nickel and dimed. He has put money away. He's got $100,000 in the bank saved up over his lifetime. That is his lifetime savings. And he has a stroke the day after he retires and needs to go into long-term care. And he's told he has to spend down that $100,000 before he can qualify for Medicaid. Why is that fair? Super frustrating concept, if you ask me. It like gives me goosebumps. So when we start talking about Medicaid and financial qualification for people, those are the things that they don't take into consideration. And so very, very frustrating. So we're going to...
Okay, I think it's online, but I'm trying to get it on here too. So
okay.
We'll see if we can do it. It is, but I don't know how to get it here. That's the problem.
Yeah, that one.
I know I'm trying, but it's not wanting to share.
Stop sharing first.
Hang on, let me see if I can. Then it won't share online. And I have more people.
So on.
So if I go here.
Yeah, and then that one.
That's what, online. And then it goes online. So it's online, but I can't get it to go on there. it should not be this difficult. let me see here. Let me try this. Oh, which one is it? This one? The qualifying?
Yeah.
We did lose most of the audience. Oh, I know. I'm like, oh no, people are leaving.
Those two don't even know how to do
it. Yeah.
Anyway, they know.
I don't know how to get it up there. That's so frustrating. Hang on. Let me go here. Let me go here. And let me go there.
And okay, there we go.
There we go. Okay. I think that's as good as it's going to get. Or maybe not. Oh, there we go.
It'll work. Okay. So what we're going to do now is we're just going to build a financial overview and kind of let you guys know how you can take a look at someone's financial situation at a high level and say, kind of, this is what you would need to do to qualify, or you're already in position, or heck, this is going to be a very difficult qualification process, and an elder law attorney or a Medicaid planner would very much benefit this person. So go ahead and switch that next page for me. So the first thing that comes into play, so on your Medicaid qualification worksheet, you can take this with you. Anybody that's qualified for Medicaid, you can kind of just go down this sheet, and it's going to give you, now I should start with, this is not been evaluated by Health and Welfare. There are a lot more strategies to qualify somebody than we're going to go over today. And if any of this is really like important to you, then there are definitely resources in the Valley. You've got Aaron C. Angeli, which is going to be your top dog, Medicaid elder law attorney. He is going to be top-notch Medicaid planner. You've got Idaho Medicaid Planning, which is going to be kind of your next step down, not quite your high end. They're going to get you qualified. And then you've also got like legacy navigation is another one in the valley that is a Medicaid plan that would help get somebody in position, we call it, to qualify for Medicaid. And so the first thing that's going to affect this is what is this client's marital status? For a single person, you would only be required to prove and report on that person's finances. So this single person is going to be somebody who has never been married, somebody who is widowed, or somebody who is divorced, obviously legally divorced, mind you. A lot of people come in and they're like, we haven't talked for 10 years, we're separated, but technically you're still legally married. That's a very challenging situation. It's not the same. So legally divorced, you're going to fall in this single individual category. Married couples. Now this is going to be a more complex situation because we have a lot of times one that needs care and not two people that need care. So that's a complex situation. But ultimately, whether one or both need care, we are now going to be taking into consideration both spouses' financial situation, their resources together and their income. If only one person is going into the facility, then we are still taking both into consideration, but we are going to be looking at a couple of different things. So the division of assets, first of all, is going to be the first thing. And we are going to go over the assets and income through this as well. So again, just a high overview with the assets of the couple. If one person is going into a facility and the other one is going to stay at home, Medicaid allows a community resource allowance. So this is about $3,300 in resources. If that couple's combined resources is under that $33,000, the spouse at home can keep everything. There's no spend down required. Certain steps would just have to be taken to transfer all of that into the spouse at home's name. The other spouse would then be able to qualify. We are going to look at incomes as well. And so Idaho, the first thing that we do is we combine the incomes, we split them in half, and we say, hey, is half their combined income more than our limit, which is $3,002 gross? If it's more than that, then there are a couple different strategies that we're going to do. If it's less than that, then okay, perfect. Their income's in line and they can qualify. So that's how we're looking at assets and income. When we're talking about monthly income allowance, so the personal needs allowance, Medicaid actually allows the person at home to keep up to $2,500 in combined income. So if the person going into the facility has the higher income, the person at home actually gets to keep some of theirs so their income reaches $2,500. The additional is going to be going towards share of cost. But up to $2,500, the person at home gets to keep a combined income before Medicaid the share of cost. That will affect us in a couple of different ways, which we'll get to down the line. But it is important to know that they can be treated a little bit separately. But ultimately, we have to take everybody's income into consideration when generating the plan. Go ahead and switch slides.
Okay. Hopefully, it's going to go.
One more disclaimer about this PowerPoint and presentation is my information is solely based on Idaho. Other states have different Medicaid regulations and limits. So everything I'm talking about today is in regards to the state of Idaho, not to other states. If you have other state-specific questions, again, an elder law attorney or Medicaid planner would be a really appropriate person to ask. But in the state of Idaho, all of this that I'm going over today would apply. So the second piece to seeing if somebody qualifies for an A&D or a long-term care waiver for Medicaid is going to be their age. So when we're talking about the A&D waiver specifically, we are going to say this person has to be over the age of 65. If they are not, then they have to have a disability diagnosis designated under the Social Security Act. There's a whole like list of things under the Social Security Act that are designated as a disability diagnosis. And for the sake of my PowerPoint, I didn't stick them all on there, but you can get on the Social Security's website and see that. But just know that someone actually has to have a disability diagnosis and be receiving SSI, SSD in order to qualify for an AD waiver if they're under 65. Okay, go ahead and switch to the next one for me. All right, so this is the big one. So when qualifying for an AD waiver, long-term care Medicaid, again, someone is going to have to qualify financially first. And the two areas where we're qualifying financially are our countable resources and our income. So when we are talking about countable resources, the biggest thing to note is that Medicaid is only looking at the first day of the month to see if somebody qualifies. They're looking before any deposits and any transactions. So if somebody gets their Social Security on the first of the month, that's not the number you're going for after that deposit. You are going for the end of day balance on the last day of last month. That ending day balance is your resources, will be your resource number. And we'll go over that a little bit further too, but your resources, they're only looking at the first day of the month to see if someone qualifies. That is a kicker for a lot of people because they may have $2,010 on the first of the month and they spent it down and now they only have $1,000 on the 15th and they apply. Medicaid says, nope, you can't qualify this month because the first of the month you had $2,010.
Yeah.
You cannot apply until the first of next week. Okay, so that's a really important thing.
Yeah.
So again, when they're looking at resources, they're looking at the first of the month. So we have to be under first of the month. That's in position. Okay. So the things that are counting towards these countable resources are going to be first off on your list here. I do have just a little bit better talk. So the first thing you're going to do when looking at countable resources is you're going to ask about property. What type of real property does this person have? In the state of Idaho, some of the biggest things are cabins and land. Those things are a big kicker for people. If you have additional property over your primary residence, that is going, the value of that property is going to be counted in your $2,000 limit. If it's a piece of land, one of the strategies that can be used is if that piece of land is generating income. So if there is a little garden on it and some vegetables get sold at a fruit stand, it makes $100 a month. That whole property is now exempt from your resource limit and your $100 a month now counts towards your income. So there are strategies to preserve that land and still qualify for Medicaid. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people are going to be told that they have to sell that land and spend down that money in order to qualify. That's not true. You just have to position yourself correctly. So if it's receiving any income, then you could preserve that land. If there are, if it's a spousal situation, there's potential that the value of that land could be transferred to the community spouse, the spouse at home, so that they can retain that. But we would be, Idaho is a community resource state, so they're going to take the total combined resources, split those in half, and say he gets to keep his half, or the person at home gets to keep their half. The person going into the facility, their half has to be spent down under this $2,000 limit. So the value of that land is going to be considered. If that value of that land is over $2,000, that could be part of the spouse at home's retain amount. Does that make sense? So if we had $100,000 in the bank, but I had land that's worth $60,000, that's $160,000 that they're going to be dividing. So $80,000 each we get to keep. If I wanted to keep the land worth $60,000, I would only be able to keep $20,000 in cash. My spouse's half, his $80,000, would have to be spent down. Does that make sense?
So who, okay, that's a lot of just money moving around.
Yes.
And all kinds of stuff. So number one, who finds or who looks at the money, like the cash, the savings, all of that?
Yes.
And then if you hire somebody to help you navigate through that, that would be like David Wilson and his team can help you navigate through some of that stuff as well, right?
Yes, exactly. So these strategies that I'm talking about are definitely something that if they are of interest to you, I would utilize, yeah, I would call Aaron DeAngeli and ask some questions, do a free consultation there and sign up to do some planning, Medicaid planning, or Idaho Medicaid planning. And what these guys are going to do is they're going to do this intake that we're essentially building today. They're going to build this high overview, and then they're going to be able to, from there, see what you need to do to qualify. So I'll leave out some of the major details right now as we build this high overview to kind of simplify this process a little bit for us. And then we can dive into some of the strategies, you know, later down the line. But again, the first thing that a Medicaid planner is going to do is they're going to need to identify all of the countable assets. So we're going to, again, we're going to ask about property. Value of property over the primary residence typically is going to be considered. Vehicles. Each person is allowed to have one vehicle that's exempt from the Medicaid application. So for a couple, they can exempt two vehicles. For a single person, one vehicle. Now, keep in mind, again, in the state of Idaho, some things that are going to get people are your ATVs, your snowmobiles, your trailers, your horse trailers, your RVs. All of those types of things that are registered with the DMV are going to count on your vehicles, and the value of that will be counted if it's above your primary vehicle. The next thing that they're going to do is they're going to come down the list and they're going to say, okay, what do you have for stocks, bonds, and mutual funds? What are the values of all your accounts there? And they're going to drop that down. They're also going to ask about 401ks and IRAs. How much money do you have in 401ks and IRAs? Now, one thing to note with 401ks and IRAs are this amount is potentially exempt from the resource limit, but you have to be taking an RMD, a required minimum distribution. That required minimum distribution now becomes income. So the whole amount of the IRA would be exempt, and the distribution would be counted as income. That's how that would be treated with Medicaid. Life insurance is another one that they're going to ask about. So what do you have for life insurance policies? Term policies, there's nothing counted in a term policy. The one thing to keep in mind is that term policies typically have a premium that's due. And so if somebody is going on to Medicaid, long-term care, or assisted living Medicaid, they're going to have a very limited personal needs allowance. So are they going to be able to keep paying the premium of that term policy? Something to consider. But your life insurance policies are the big one. Your life insurance policies are going to have a cash value that's assigned with those. That cash value counts towards your resource limit. There are ways to preserve that. There are ways to transfer ownership of those policies to a spouse or a child so that they become the owner of that cash, essentially. But there are some dangers with going that way. So again, I would involve a Medicaid planner or an elder law attorney to be able to help explain how to appropriately handle a life insurance policy, a whole life insurance policy specifically. And then they're going to ask about prepaid burials. That is a great way to spend down some of the funds if people have additional funds. They can prepay a burial, and then that burial and the funds used for that would become exempt from Medicaid. As long as that burial is irrevocably assigned to the funeral home and someone can go cash it out for the dollar amount, it will have to be used for final expenses. And then all money holding accounts, so all money in the bank, any money holding account is also going to be considered in your total resource limit. So again, over here, some of the things that are not countable. Your house is not countable, but the caveat with that is you have to either have intent to return home or a spouse be living there. There are a couple other reasons that a house could be preserved. If you have an adult child with special needs, an adult sibling that has lived in that house with you for over a year and they paid, like if you guys went in on it and been there for 5 years and you moved out, you could actually deed that house over to your sibling and can keep that house, and that wouldn't be any transfer penalty. Or anything like that. Household goods. So a lot of questions that we get are household goods or personal effects, like wedding rings. Your household stuff is, nobody counts that in your countable resources. Where you're going to run into trouble with this is if you have like a giant gun collection and it's insured, that's countable. If you've got some giant collection, very valuable collection, especially if it's insured, those things need to be recorded. Those would count. Obviously, burial plots. And then you can, burial resource is what it's called, up to $1,500 of either money in the bank, cash value, life insurance policy, potentially a vehicle, burial resources, the form with Medicaid that you fill out saying that $1,500 of this value is designated for a burial, and they'll exempt that amount. So sometimes that strategy, if someone is just over the income limit, can bring them back down. So that's a good strategy. All right, let's switch to the next slide for me.
Okay. So after Medicaid verifies someone's resources, one more thing. Again, Medicaid only looks first day of the month before any deposits or transactions to see if someone's under that resource limit. So they're taking the bank account balances on the first before any transactions and the value of any of those other countable resources combined to see if that's over 2,000. If it is, you need a Medicaid planner to position yourself to be under that 2,000 to be able to qualify. Or you would do a spend down is what it's called. Spend any money down to get you under that 2,000. So that on the first of next month, you have less than 2,000 in the bank or in combined resources, so then you can qualify. So that's your resource side. Then you've got your income side. Medicaid says in the state of Idaho, a single person can make up to $3,002 gross per month and still be able to qualify for Medicaid. A couple is going to be able to, it's just under $6,000. They get about $3,002 each that they, for income, before they would be required to have what's called the Miller Trust. So without a Miller Trust, over $3,002 would disqualify you from Medicaid. You would not be able to qualify. Now, what a Miller Trust is, it is a very confusing term. There's a lot of misconception and confusion out there about what a Miller Trust is. So a Miller Trust is an income trust only. It is a bank account at a bank, typically. Sometimes a skilled nursing facility can hold this account. But typically it's at a bank account. The thing that makes it exempt or turns it into a Miller Trust is a legal document by a lawyer saying that this account is designated to fund medical needs only. Anything that goes into that account is irrevocably, is you can't pull it out for any reason other than to cover medical needs. It is a income trust. So the use of it, it is a really stupid rule. Your income comes in to your bank account right here. And you have a bill that comes from the facility right here. Your income is over your $3,002 per month. So Medicaid says you do not qualify for Medicaid unless you get rid of that income. You do something with it. So in order to disqualify it, we move any excess income from this bank account, we transfer it into this other bank account, the Miller Trust account, and then we have to pay the facility over here still. So we drain this account, we write a check here to the facility for whatever the overage was, and then the remaining share of costs that we pay the facility, we pay it out of our bank account. So literally the money is coming in here. We move an account so we can pay all to the same place. It is a stupid rule. Some states have moved away from it. It is what it is. In Idaho, we still have it. And so that is all a Miller Trust is a special bank account that houses the additional income so that somebody can now qualify for Medicaid. It has to be used towards the cost of care. Can't be used for anything else. So every month you would want to drain that account to pay towards the cost of care, and then any remaining balance that you have, you pay out of your bank account to cover that. Does that make sense?
So is it almost like an HSA type thing? So you could put your income, could you just start a Miller Trust all by itself and then just keep it going and then pay? No, okay.
No. And so here, the thing with the Miller Trust is that if you had a Miller Trust prior to qualifying for Medicaid, so how would this be?
I mean, you don't have to figure it out today. I just was curious,
If you had a Miller Trust prior to qualifying for Medicaid, like if it didn't, it has to have the legal documentation accompanying that account to say, that's what makes it valid to Medicaid. Because It says any money in here is irrevocably assigned, essentially, can only be used for medical expenses. And so, I mean, any money in a Miller Trust after a person passes away is subject to Medicaid recovery.
Oh, okay.
And so you wouldn't want to build up a balance in your
in
your Miller Trust, because as soon as you pass away, that's subject for Medicaid to come back and recover.
Gotcha. Not for the cost. That's why you want to train it.
Yeah. Yes.
You're doing a great job. Very complicated stuff. Quick question. So this Miller Trust, you have to have that trust prior to getting on Medicaid, or is that just part of being on Medicaid because you over?
Yeah, you would need it prior to applying. So you would have to, yeah, so you would need to meet with a lawyer, have that document drawn up, go into the bank, give them that document, open this bank account in the name of the Miller Trust, and then your income would come in for that month, and you would send the overage to the Miller Trust, and you would be providing Medicaid all the documentation to show that.
Prior to being on the
app, with your application, when you send it into Medicaid, you would send them the proof of the legal documents, proof of the bank accounts, both bank accounts showing this is my bank account, that's the income that went in there, and then this is the Miller Trust, this is what I moved over. You would report that to Medicaid, and they would say, okay, so now your income is in line and you would qualify. So this would have to be done prior to applying, and you would send all that documentation in with your application to show Medicaid that what you've done to get your income in.
I think a lot of people probably don't know about this, and
yes,
they even can't afford it because you have to hire
yes.
an attorney and have
yes.
all that stuff, right?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So there is an attorney in Nampa. His name is Sean Miller. It's Miller Law, and he works with Idaho Medicaid Planning. Idaho Medicaid Planning did a deal with him to be the, I don't have a better term for it, the Walmart lawyer,
mm-hmm.
do a lot for a little. And so they feed him clients to make sure that their POAs are in line, to make sure that, you know, if they need a Miller Trust, he's popping out those things for them. If we need to deed over a house or some type of property, that's where he comes into play. So Idaho Medicaid Planning is like more of your a la carte, like, I need this service. And then elder law attorneys like MC Angeli are going to be like your big boutique, like, all your services and your planning, your wills, all of that
yes.
should be included. But Idaho Medicaid Planning, you know, Sean's with you, he can do your will, he can do trust, he can do your Miller Trust and all of that kind of stuff. So they're kind of separate in that way.
Miller Law, you said?
Miller Law.
Which
yes.
is ironic that he does the Miller Trust.
yes. Ironically. And he didn't make it up, believe
yeah.
it or not. So, yeah, so that's the big thing with income. So with income, the things that are going to be considered, your monthly Social Security, and so SSI, SSD income is all going to be included. Any investments from bank accounts or like oil dividends, anything like that would all be considered in your income. Pensions, retirements. Any annuities that you have. So if you've bought like a single payer annuity and it's paying out each month, that is counted as income. And that is a strategy, which we'll go over here in a minute, to get people in line as well. And then any wages from jobs are also going to be included. And then resources. So again, this is if you had a property that was bringing in income of some kind of rental property. So if you've got two houses, one's a rental property and I live in one, I can keep the second house as long as it's bringing in income. I just have to count that under my income. And then, again, my gross income has to be under $3,002 where I have to have a Miller Trust to still qualify. Any other questions about income or Miller Trusts?
Yeah, that's really good.
It can be very confusing.
The only thing I was going to ask, because I have my son's CD waiver.
Okay.
Is he has a special needs trust.
Yes.
For people that pass away that leave him money?
Yes.
He can't put his own money in.
That special needs trust is exempt from the resource limit.
Right.
Yes. There's also a new account I just recently come to know about. It's called an ABLE account.
Yes.
And it's a very specific special needs account that.
It's the same almost as the Miller Trust.
Yep. Yep. It basically would take the over resource amount for a client. But they have some limitations. It's like $20,000 a month and up to $100,000 would be in that account. Anything under the $100,000 is exempt. Anything over that would disqualify somebody potentially from services until they get that account set back better. So there's some
yeah, and it would
nuances.
Also go when they passed away, it would actually go to health or Medicare, Medicaid.
Yes, yep, it'd be
where
your gross
special
time.
Trust doesn't.
Correct. Yeah, correct. All right, we'll switch the
okay.
screen.
I also have some questions
oh,
in the chat, just
yep.
so you know. Can you get to the chat? Thank you. Just, I mean, I don't, maybe.
It says, so we're going to work backwards. It says, what happens when there is a trust? And some, I
Ah, so if there's like a family trust or like my house is in a trust or something like that, not a special needs trust. This is just a family trust. Medicaid does not recognize trusts. So if a house is in a trust, we actually have to defund the trust and pull everything out and then deal with everything individually before we can qualify them. There is something called an irrevocable trust. Now, these are a little bit different. They're treated different. So the irrevocable trust, once something goes in there, it can't come out. That's going to cause an issue if we have a house in a trust and it's been put in there within the last 5 years. And we'll go over why. But that would cause a penalty period because all of that would be counted as a gift to the trust. And so if stuff went into an irrevocable trust prior to needing long-term care, 5 years prior to needing long-term care, it's exempt. They won't go back and look at it. Nobody does anything about it. It's free and clear in that trust. If it's within that 5 years, it's counted as a gift. Again, these are where your Medicaid attorneys, your Illinois law attorneys are going to come into play because they're going to pre-plan with people. Aaron C. Angeli is your pre-planning. You're putting things in trust 5 years ahead of time. You're planning for this long-term care. I have a Medicaid planning. Legacy navigation is more of your crisis planning. I'm already in long-term care and I need Medicaid now. Like we're not planning for this. I need it now. That's kind of your biggest difference. And trusts are going to be one of those tools that Aaron C. Angeli uses, your irrevocable trust, when pre-planning. They're going to put stuff in there to protect it and have certain rules, essentially, on how those things are treated and how they pay out. And if things are put in there in that trust, like if your family has a big bank account, let's say there's $1 million in the bank account, and that bank account is put to the trust 5 years prior to you needing long-term care, and it says that when you need long-term care, it'll start paying out $1,000 a month. That $1,000 a month is going to be counted as your income, but the whole amount in that trust is not counted as a resource. If that makes sense.
It's tricky, though.
It is tricky, yes.
And you do need a lawyer.
Yes. I highly suggest it.
Yes.
But it's really important to know this information because a lot of people feel like, oh, my income's too high, I'm not going to qualify. Or I have too much money in the bank, I'm not going to qualify. Or if I qualify, my spouse is going to be left with nothing. Or if I qualify, my kids are going to be left with nothing.
It's hard.
Frustrating.
So the next question is, would you happen to have information on starting an assisted living facility in California? I've been assisting seniors for the last 25 years in a variety of areas. I've been thinking about it for a while, was just wondering how difficult it would be. Thank you.
So California is one of the more tedious states to receive Medicaid from. And each state is governed. So Medicaid is a federal program, but it's managed on the state level. So each state has its own rules and policies and things for Medicaid. And then each state's Department of Health and Welfare manages their rules and regulations for assisted living. So unfortunately, I am not familiar at all with rules and regulations for California. I'm very familiar with the IDAPA rules for Idaho and how to start and qualify, get an assisted living going. So my biggest suggestion there would be to go to your local health and welfare office. I don't even know if that's what it's called in California, but go to your state health office and ask them for their rules. They should be posted online as well. There's typically your rules and regulations that would have what it takes to qualify, what it would take to, like what your administrator requirements, staffing requirements, all that kind of stuff are. So I would say visit your state health website and they should be able to direct you more on that.
Yeah. Quick question about the state combined code. So, there's a lot of changes coming up in the state of work requirements.
Yes.
And redetermination. How is that impacting?
So we haven't seen it impacting getting people qualified for Medicaid other than our process is slower because of some of the funding on like the nurse reviewers and keeping staff in Medicaid to be able to get people moved through the process. So we've seen kind of a slowdown with the application process, but as far as getting people on services,
Medicaid was actually designed to for long-term. And so we don't see a lot of changes in that realm. Where we see changes are going to be like our adult basic, our enhanced Medicaid. That's really where a lot of the cuts are happening. We have definitely seen some cuts within like our ResHab and assisted living across the board. In September of last year, we got 4% cuts, and then we're just getting another like 3 or 4%. We've been fighting like right now the legislature, we've been fighting, battling back and forth. I mean, they were all over the place on what they were going to do as far as funding for the disabilities community. We did have some cuts. They weren't as extreme as we thought. In ResHab, you know, they are doing some additional things. We're going to have some facility audits and audits on like how funds are being used within ResHab that are going to dictate some of how things are working in the future. So we're still kind of in the midst of all of that right now.
Is going to be another cut?
So it takes place in July, yeah. They, in March, when the legislature closed, they, I want to say it's another 4%.
And that's not going to affect ResHab or previous?
It possibly will. Those cuts in July, I mean, our companies feel like they can weather it. Some companies may not be able to. But they're honing in on how ResHab agencies are using their funding. And so they're doing audits to figure out like how much of that funding is going towards direct care staff, how much is going towards the administration, how much is going towards housing. And those numbers that they're going to be, I believe they're going to start getting those numbers from us at the beginning of the year. And so we're getting that information now to start being able to plan for that. But yeah, they're getting our numbers at the beginning of the year so that they can start, I think, making some more of those changes. But,
and that does include certified families.
I think certified family homes, they're under a different set of rules and regulations than we are. I know that the
it's usually more stringent.
Yeah, I know that the cuts in September were across the board, and really not 100% sure how the cuts coming up in July are going to affect like certified family homes or assisted livings. I know for us, I mean, we're getting them in ResHab. I think it's across the board, but I
just want to put this out there. I think it's really important for us not to freaked out about it. I know at the end of the day, there'll probably be some changes, but I know ResHab and long-term care and waivers and stuff like that, those are all the ones that they have to try and protect as much as possible because they're federally regulated. So the federal government mandates that the states keep in place a certain amount of funding for cares for the most vulnerable and, you know, chronically sick and disabled of our community. So we like to wait until everything kind of settles down and see where it happens, because we know that at the end of the day, they will try to maintain as much care as possible for them. So.
Yeah, it's just certified family homes, at least from my point of view, because I've been doing this many years, has no one to tell you. You find out when you paid yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, then you have to go in and rebuild and everything, because all of a sudden you now have a 4% decrease. There's no one that actually informs certified family homes of these changes.
I also always recommend people with certified family homes, if you're not part of Peyton Horn, do you do social media at all?
No.
Okay. So Vicki Horn is a really great expert in the certified family home realm. She tries to keep up to date with a lot of what's going on, and she tries to share out information with certified family home providers. I can try to get her contact information and see if anyone, if she does like emails or anything like that. But I know on that social media page that she runs, she tries to share out kind of up-to-date information. And be like, hey, you know, we've seen this letter mailed out, keep your eye out for it. Or we've seen this announcement come out, keep your eye out for it. That's what I usually recommend people in the certified family home, you know, space to do, so that you don't feel like you're the last one to know. Because I know it can be really frustrating. We work in a major company, and sometimes we're waiting until they give us the final say.
Right. It's like if I call like my representative, they're always saying, well, you know before we do. And that's very disheartening that you're the agency that is responsible for checking to see if I'm doing what I'm supposed to do, and yet you don't have the information.
I guarantee you, it's a complicated system, and we try to work together to, you know, share all the information as much as we can. Another good resource, so IDHW has a member advisory committee that's open to the community, happens quarterly. I can share that information with Kim, yeah. She can send it out to the groups, but community members can come on and listen to the announcements that are coming from Medicaid themselves. So this is like from the horse's mouth, as they say, and those are quarterly. They make announcements, they give updates on like what's happening, changes on rates, and different things like that that happen at that state level. And I think it's usually typically towards the beginning or middle of the meeting, they allow community members to ask questions and give input and comments and stuff like that. Depending on the way the meeting's going that day, they will have answers back for you. And sometimes they say, okay, we're going to take that information and then we will bring, you know, answers back on the next meeting. So it's really important to be, you know, as certified family home providers, to be there and have your voices heard as well. I know since I'm on that committee, I've been on the committee for about a year, we'll sometimes see certified family home providers of like children, like 0 to 18. So I think it's a different program, but, you know, similar type of caregiver on there. But yeah, so it is open to the public. You can come and listen to be kind of more in the know.
Years ago, there used to be a quarterly newsletter that went out electronically that I signed up for. It was great. I got the latest stuff, and it just all of a sudden I noticed that I didn't come anymore.
And maybe that was something we can ask Steve Miller to see if he's still doing it or if they're thinking about starting it up again.
Just for announcements. Sorry. Is that all of, was that all that was in the chat? Sorry.
There was a question, and it was, who is responsible for cleaning Reds have homes and meat?
Ooh, good question. So ultimately, the clients in the house are responsible for their house chores and cleaning up after themselves. However, when we have the client assessed for their functional abilities and limitations, we evaluate their ability to follow through on their house chores, their laundry, their ability to cook for themselves, all that type of stuff. So it can play into our care plans. And our houses, I was actually pleasantly surprised when I came over. I started getting some pictures of our houses because I wanted to see like what I was marketing for. And we have really nice homes throughout the valley. We've got a variety. I mean, some places that we have apartments, townhouses, and then we've got some single family homes, but they're decent houses. Like they're in pretty good shape. But each house, because of the clients in each house, it's going to be maintained a little bit differently. You know, some clients are a little bit cleaner.
Oh, can you not hear me? Can people hear us? Can you type?
I can now.
Okay. Sorry. I think the internet connection went a little bit south on us. So, okay. We'll continue then. So on the next slide.
Right.
So after a client qualifies financially for the A&B waiver, that next step is going to be qualifying on the medical side of things. So in order to do that, if someone is in assisted living or at home requesting home care through Medicaid, they are going to have what's called an L-CERT filled out with a specific form through Medicaid that a doctor has to sign, indicating this person needs help with two or more activities of daily living. So you've got your activities of daily living listed over here, and they can be a variety of different needs, like a variation of different levels of need. Like somebody with bathing, it could just be standby assist into the shower. It doesn't have to be necessarily help you with the whole shower process. So dressing, same thing. It could just be like snapping buttons and zipping zippers. That would be assistance needed with an activity of daily living. So it doesn't necessarily matter the intensity of each of these activities. It just matters that we're needing help with two or more activities. Medication management would be another one I don't think made the list. And then once they qualify on the L-CERT, then they're going to send the referral over to the long-term care bureau, nurse reviewers, for them to reach out and get that UAI. If somebody's in a skilled nursing facility, the skilled nursing facility is going to upload to Medicaid, it's called a PASAR, it's their admission document saying, hey, this person's coming to skilled nursing. That does house information from the doctor saying why they're there, which typically is enough information saying, yep, they need a skilled nursing or a nursing home level of care, and they'll go ahead and send them over to that long-term care bureau of nurse reviewers.
I'm getting some feedback because they can't see the PowerPoint.
I think I just restarted it. Can you guys see the PowerPoint again? Sorry.
Yep, we can see.
Okay, yep. Thank you guys. We all need the feedback. Okay. Thank you so much.
Yeah, we go ahead and switch to the next one. All right. So this slide here just talks about that UAI assessment. So again, this kind of goes over, we verify with the L-CERT, or the admission document from skilled nursing that somebody needs to help with activities of daily living. Then our referral is sent over to the long-term care bureau of nurse reviewers. We're waiting about 4 weeks for them to call us back, get that scheduled. Once that's scheduled, she will come over and meet with us and do that assessment. And then that is going to generate our level of care, our daily rate. And then that nurse reviewer also makes a referral if they're coming to ResHab for that next step, which is SIBAR.
It's quite the process, isn't it?
It is quite the process, yes. And the biggest bottleneck with getting people into ResHab services is getting them on the A&B waiver and the DD waiver. Because if they're in a skilled nursing facility or in the hospital, we cannot request that waiver because they're not in the facility that they're going to end up in. So at that point, we have to utilize a couple of different resources. One of them is potentially the Idaho Home Choice Program, which is a program through Medicaid that helps people transition from a facility setting back out into the community. In order for someone to utilize this program, they do already have to be on some type of Medicaid, and they have to be in a institutional setting, so skilled nursing or hospital, for 45 days is the minimum. 60 days is really the sweet spot. You get more benefits if you're there for the 60 days. But what Idaho Home Choice Program offers is an advocate that helps facilitate the UAI. It makes it so we can backfill to the discharge date for that client, even though we may not have that UAI until further in the future. They offer a $2,000 grant that can help with moving costs, so furniture, clothes, potentially deposits, that kind of stuff. So Idaho Home Choice is a great resource for us to transition clients from a skilled nursing or a hospital type setting. However, if they haven't been there for the 45 days or 60 days, or they're not on Medicaid, then we have to start the process from the beginning. And that is verifying the financial eligibility by calling in, and we can do that over the phone a lot of times. Then we have to send in bank statements and other verifying documents. Once they prove all that, then we're in line for the nurse reviewer, which takes us about 4 weeks to get scheduled. And what we're finding right now is the nurse reviewers are bogged down, and so they're not doing a lot of, like, digging. They usually make one phone call to the number on the case, and if nobody answers and the case is closed, they don't exist. And so I can't tell you how frustrating it is to get 4 weeks into this process and then find out, like, we have to start over. So that's super fun.
Okay, you guys switch to the next one.
And I think that's the end.
Start with, yep, the application process all over. So we would have to have them reopen the case. A lot of times they would want us to recoup financial situation. And then we would get back into you for the nurse reviewer. A couple times we've even made sure that we had, you know, my phone number, our agency's phone number. Somehow they call a phone number that wasn't connected to anybody and closed the case. And it's just more people. So, yeah, just guiding people kind of through that process has been very, very
good. You said that there's only two for the state.
Mm-hmm.
Is there not budget for more?
Solid question.
Okay.
Just to kind of again review some of the strategies for qualifying for an AAP waiver. With a married couple going into, or if one person was going into services and the other person was staying home, we can transfer everything to the spouse at home. So because Idaho is a community resource state, it will take both spouses' resources into consideration. If those combined resources are under that $33,000, the community spouse resource allowance, the spouse at home can keep everything and get the other person qualified for Medicaid. If they're over that $33,000, the community spousal resource allowance, they're going to take that countable resources, they're going to split them in half. They're going to say, this half is hers, she can keep, or the spouse at home, they get to keep all this, their half. And then the one going into the facility, this person has to spend their half down under $2,000, and then we can qualify them. Now, the way that we can preserve this half is we put it into what's called a Medicaid-compliant annuity. It is an annuity that is specific. It's the only type of annuity that Medicaid will exempt because it's irrevocably assigned to Medicaid, essentially. That's not true. A Medicaid compliant annuity is money that goes in. It's a single payment and a single payment annuity. So it's typically a blue amount. So if you have $100,000, needs to be spent down under $2,000 to qualify. So we would take about $98,000. We would put this into this Medicaid compliant annuity. We would break that up over the course of 48 months, essentially. I can't math real fast. So about $2,000, a little over $2,000 a month, he would be receiving as income. So that total resource that went into that annuity is exempt because once it goes in there, it's going to pay out $2,000 a month for 48 months. There's no changing that. You can't change that. That's what makes it exempt from Medicaid. So once it goes in there, it's going to pay out $2,000 a month. It's going to pay to the home spouse, though. So now it's considered income for this person as well. We may have to have a Miller trust. But I can keep all of their half in the form of an annuity. So I get it back as a monthly payment as opposed to a blue amount. That's how I'm able to get my spouse's other half of their income. So that's one of my favorite strategies because the biggest fear I hear with couples is I have to care for my loved one because if I send them to a skilled nursing facility or assisted living to be able to get the care that they need, I'm going to miss out on my lifestyle or I'm going to have to change my lifestyle, my house. It's going to drain me of everything in order to get them care. So I better do this for them. I better take on the care, which causes a whole slew of other issues typically. So we can preserve that half for the home spouse. There's also gifting plans where we can use that Medicaid compliant annuity to gift to a family member if we want. So that's actually one thing I should speak about is the penalty period, the gifting period, the 5-year look back. Those are some other terms that you may have heard when talking about Medicaid. So Medicaid does have an interface where they can look back over the last 5 years and see major assets, houses, vehicles, major sums of money typically. And they are going to work to identify anything that has been gifted. And so a gifted amount is something that's been given away. Typically, it's going to be over $100 in 1 month. That's anything less than that, I don't really look at. But over $100 in a month, then they're going to start to kind of look into that. And what a gift is transferring resources to a third party, anything identified to do that. So that could be to a child, that could be to, if you don't do it right, to a spouse. It could be to, a scam. Somebody could scan your account, that could be considered a gift. You could transfer your house to your kids and not get any money for it, and that house is a gift. You can sell your house to your kids for $1. If you don't get fair market value of that house, everything above, like between that dollar and fair market value, is counted as a gift. So Medicaid looks back over the last 5 years and they are identifying these amounts that have been gifted. And anything that has been gifted, they're going to total that up. They're going to divide that total number by the average cost of care. Right now in the state of Idaho, that number is $10,901.03 per month. So take that total amount, we're going to divide it by 10,901. That's going to give us the number of months that somebody has to be in position to qualify for Medicaid, but they are not paying the bill until they get to the end of that penalty period. We can use this penalty period as a strategy sometimes. If we are taking a single person and we are qualifying them for Medicaid, so let's take our Paul B, for instance. He's got $100,000 in the bank. He needs to spend that down under $2,000 in order to qualify. We can gift about 60% of that to a child, retain the 40%, put that into a Medicaid compliant annuity. That annuity we would design to pay out the difference between his income and the cost of care for the penalty period that we create. So we design a plan to pay privately with that 40% for the penalty period that we know that we're creating, because we're preserving 60% of my lump sum for my kids. So now I can qualify, my kids got some money, Medicaid's happy because I'm in line, and I get my long-term care funded by Medicaid. Facility's happy because they get their payment, I'm happy because I get my care, my kids are happy because I got the big lump sum.
Yeah, it's crazy.
But I don't recommend leaving your kids anything. Honestly, I recommend life insurance.
Oh, interesting.
You can get $1 million life insurance policy for pennies on the dollar and leave your kids $1 million in life insurance, as opposed to trying to save up all your money over the course of your life and making it through a long-term care stay and being able to leave.
Can you do that after you're 65, though?
There are life insurance policies that can be available.
Yeah.
I would have to dive into exactly which ones, because some of them do have income limits and medical like requirements and that kind of thing. So typically life insurance, again, is going to be one of those pre-planning things. But as I've been learning through my journey and everybody else's, you know, what they're going through in senior living, is don't plan to leave your kids your money. Spend your money, live your life, buy a life insurance policy, buy a annuity. Those are your paychecks.
Okay.
Any questions?
I think that's other questions. Thank you, Mallory, so much. And just so you guys know, the certificates will be emailed out even to you two that are here. And then I'll be sending out the resources. So the Idaho Medicare Planning, law firms, Sean Miller, Vicki Horn, probably. And of course, your information as well. So thank you so much. I'm sorry. This was a crazy hybrid. I don't know if I'm going to do it again. We'll see. We'll see what happens. You were my guinea pig and it was kind of brutal. I'm sorry. we do have Norco. No, you're not Norco, are you? Okay. Well, we have Melina. Melina, who, again, thank you so much for them being a, get through this. Hang on. Sorry. We'll be doing a gift card giveaway. I think we need to give it to somebody who's here.
So really quickly, I did just want to remind anybody who has, if you have a Molina member, if you're caring for a Molina member, we have some new resources out there. And so we just wanted to make sure that everybody had been coming on.
I think you might have to come up here. Can you guys hear her? I'm going to stop sharing. Well, I'm not going to stop sharing because there's nothing to see. But Okay.
So I just wanted to let anyone who does have Melina that we have some resources that are kind of new, and then some resources that we've had a while that some people don't know about. And we like to make sure people are aware and can access them. So we just started doing Teladoc in Idaho, and I know Teladoc's not for everyone, but it is there, so we want to make sure that people know it, especially when you're having challenges with transportation. If it's, you know, something simple like an ear infection or maybe a UTI or something like that, that a Teladoc provider can help you with. If you're a Molina member or you're caring for somebody who is a Molina member, they now have access to that. If you need more information, you can reach out to me or any of our enrollment advisors, or if you're working with a broker or a care coordinator, they can help you get in contact with the people you're enrolling with that Teladoc service. Also, we wanted to let you know that we have Truelta, which is a resource for people who are managing, you know, chronic conditions, or maybe they're caring for someone with a disability that maybe has a new chronic condition. Truelta is there for caregivers. It's a free service. You can jump on there and learn more. You can watch the little videos. You can participate in support groups. That is, again, all free. All you have to be is either a member of Molina or a caregiver of someone who has Molina. And lastly, we have our member advisory committee coming up. Much like the one that I described with IPHW, it's where people can join who are either members or caregivers. We allow certified family home caregivers or like family caregivers to attend on behalf of someone they're caring for or with somebody that they're caring for. At these events, we usually share out information. For example, we had a representative from Truelta jump on and show us how to use their Truelta program for our last one. And then we had a care coordinator on there as well that kind of helped explain what a care coordinator can help you with if you have Molina. So it was a really good information. Next session, we'll be having an expert from the Teladoc come and share how to use Teladoc, you know, what types of services you can receive when you use a Teladoc type of service, and how you can reach out to them to get enrolled if you want to. We're also going to be talking about either brain health or mental health type of subject. We're still kind of walking that down, but that is also free for all members to join. And we really encourage you to come and ask those questions. Like, we probably can't answer questions such as the IDHW questions that come up. However, we can help you get in contact with the people that can. And, you know, for later meetings, and, you know, sometimes we can invite guests to come and share with our members if there's specific questions and stuff like that. So it's a great resource. But yeah, that's all I wanted to share. So for today, I have a gift card, and I brought somewhere back there, but it's a little cooler, a little Molina cooler, and a little cup. So today, I don't know, can pick?
Well, I think the people that were here would be great, because they had to drive here.
So there's that. Two people here.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know.
I'll just do the, yeah.
Okay.
That'd be great.
What was your name?
Verna.
Okay, so everybody, Verna wins today's gift card. Thank you all for attending. We really appreciate all the questions that everybody has. You know, I try to throw out questions that I know that people ask. But yeah, thanks again, everybody, and I hope you enjoyed the conference.
Yep. Thank you so much. I'll be mailing out the certificates of attendance. Please save the date for the workshop, October 22nd. That's when our next one will be. Oh, do you want to say something more? I am so sorry. Okay.
I have a tribal affairs side.
Oh, yes. Okay.
So, which is a totally different discussion, but mm-hmm. I think we can have a discussion about that. But thank you so much. But I learned so much today. I'm new to Molina, so work alongside with you guys.
Yeah.
But,
thank you. And yeah. I'm sorry, you need to tell everybody your name. Oh, and
I work with tribal liaison for Molina. And Molina, along with United Healthcare and the state of Idaho, they're trying to build a relationship with the tribes, the five tribal nations in Idaho. So the tribal liaison positions are all new.
2026, I think, because of the Medicaid changes and stuff. So they're really trying to get more enrolled members on Medicaid and trying to build that awareness. So this would be a great conversation to have.
Yeah, for another, yeah, I agree. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Okay, everybody, thank you so much. I really appreciate you jumping online and seeing us, and we will see you guys shortly. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you guys for coming. I still like coming versus on.
Yeah, I know. I just need to figure out a way to do it so that we can do it.